Hey, sister. Welcome back. If you listened before, and hello, if this is your first time here on the Daily Momtra podcast, I'm your host, Jessie Truelove. You can connect with me on social media at Move With Truelove or in my fitness app for mamas at movewithtruelove.com. Today, we are getting nerdy. I mean, seriously, like science, history, anthropology. I sit down with Dina Imira, an evolutionary biologist. She published a book, A Brief History of the Female Body. She has a master's in biological anthropology and a PhD in evolutionary biology. She studies the evolution of the female reproductive system in mammals. She is seriously smart, and just looking at the topics of her studies are mind-blowing. This conversation was incredibly interesting. Keep your mind open with this one as we take a look at the history of reproduction and, as Dina puts it, the maternal-fetal conflict. Let's dive into the show. Okay, welcome back. You are listening to the Daily Momtra podcast, and I am your host, Jessie Truelove. Today, I'm joined with Dina Imira, who is going to be talking to us all about menstrual cycles, periods, the evolution of the female body, and so much more. I found a TikTok or a reel of you speaking about periods and the kind of the evolution of the female cycle and maybe why that came to be. And it was so interesting. So I thought I have to have you on because I'm so interested in hormones and the cycle, like the female cycle right now. I feel like it's something that really was a miss for our generation growing up. Like I feel like the only part of our cycle we're really familiar with and also has been demonized is our period. So I feel like having more of a full circle moment about our cycle, about our hormones with somebody like you is going to be so fun and just a really interesting episode. So thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah. And I'd love to just kick it off with you introducing yourself, telling us a little bit about your background. This feels very specialized. So how did you find yourself wanting to, I've literally never heard anybody talking about the things that you're talking about. So like, how did you find yourself in this field and like why and how and your book? You have a book out that I've heard amazing reviews on from all sorts of people that are also in this field. So go ahead, just introduce yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a good question. How did I get into this very niche field? So, you know, when I'm talking to people, I describe myself as an evolutionary biologist. And so that has been like a common thread through all my education. So I'm very passionate about evolution and also education. So like those two things like keep popping in and out of my life. So I got really interested in human evolution when I was in college. I went on this Neanderthal dig in France in this cave, which is really cool. So that like focus was on biology, but like I had a special focus on human evolution. Mm-hmm. And then I taught high school for a few years out of college. So that's like that education piece. But then I wanted to go back to school. So I first got a master's in biological anthropology.
What is that?
Is the study of how the human body has changed and why. I mean, there's so many different subfields, but like a paleontologist, for example, that goes, you know, and hunts for human, you know, Neanderthal fossils, like that's, you know, a biological anthropologist or a human paleontologist. I mean, there's lots of different ways to describe, people focused on that. I actually, in that master's program at NYU, I decided, you know, bones are cool, but I don't know that I want to be like, it's a very tedious thing to be digging for fossils.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yes. So it's fun. But I became much more intellectually interested anyway in looking at genes and DNA as a way to understand the past. So I kind of broadened my sort of, study. So I wasn't just focused on humans. So that's when I got my PhD in evolutionary biology, where I wasn't just focused on humans. I was focused on, in my case, all mammals. And so that's where I really got interested during my PhD on the female reproductive system. And that was just kind of happenstance. I didn't, you know, I chose a lab. You know, when you train for a PhD, you have to choose a lab. And the person who heads that lab has a bunch of questions that they're asking already, and you kind of find a project within that. And so the lab I joined, I was just really excited about the work that this one professor was doing, and it happened to be on the female reproductive system. So he was working on the evolution of pregnancy and how mammals went from basically laying eggs. So there are some egg-laying mammals in Australia that are still around today. And we think the very first mammals laid eggs. So how did we go from laying eggs to growing our children inside our bodies? And it's not obviously just humans who do this. You know, most mammals get pregnant and, you know, carry a baby for, you know, the bigger mammals carry their babies for over a year. You know, like elephants and certain whales. So anyway, I got really interested in how those changes happen in evolution. So how do you go from like laying an egg to actually growing your baby inside your body? And
yeah, you know, like what mammal makes, is it also laying eggs? Yeah.
The platypus and the echidna.
Oh yeah, a platypus.
Yeah, the platypus lays eggs. They're these, they don't look like chicken eggs. They're, the outside of them is really leathery. So the the eggshell looks a little bit different, but they lay eggs. I mean, it's,
and they also know, like, do they nurse their babies?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So, so it's the nursing of babies that is one of the sort of defining features of mammals, not pregnancy, because the platypus doesn't get pregnant. You know, they basically wrap their embryos in an egg, lay it, and then incubate the eggs. And really, when those eggs hatch, when a platypus egg hatches, it still looks like an embryo. So most of the development.
And then what?
Most of the development is happening at the teat. Well, actually, the platypus doesn't have a teat. They just sort of, they express the milk on their bellies. There's no nipples. And the babies just sort of slurp the milk up.
Okay.
So most of the development happens like in a protected place, you know, on the belly of the animal. There's not very many egg-laying mammals.
Yeah.
There's a lot of mammals that get pregnant. So clearly like that innovation in mammals was really, it worked. Exactly. It made them super successful as a group. Okay. So we got stuck on that for a while.
The platypus has just intrigued me for a minute.
I know it's fascinating. And we don't have to go too much into this, but then there's a third. So there's the placental mammals, we call them. So they're the ones that get pregnant. There's the egg-laying mammals, the platypus and echidna. And then there's this other group of mammals called the marsupials, which I'm sure you've heard of these things, like kangaroos. Totally. Opossums. These guys are also really cool. They don't lay eggs. Well, they actually, when they're in their mother, the mom does wrap them up in an egg, but then the egg hatches while it's in the mother. And then very, very, very briefly, the egg attaches to the mother's uterine lining. But in the case of marsupials, that causes her to give birth because it's like this irritation to her uterus. Basically, we think probably like the enzymes that digest the eggshell off the egg are irritating to the mom's uterus. And so the marsupial gives birth. And so they're also born looking like embryos. And they also do most of their development on the teat.
So interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, so my PhD was on that. And I got really interested in the evolution of periods while I was, you know, because a lot of my work on pregnancy focused on the mother's uterus. So the changes that had to happen on the side of the mom in order for, you know, the placenta is this really complex structure that's made by the baby. Most people don't actually know that the placenta is made by the baby. And so you've got this really complex sort of connection happening between the baby's placenta and the mom's uterus. And for that connection to work, both sides had to evolve a lot of new changes. I was studying what was happening in the mom. And as I was studying that, I started thinking a lot about periods because some mammals get periods. We're not the only ones. There are some others. And I just got really interested in the question of why do we have periods? Who have, other than humans, who have periods? How did periods evolve? So, you know, a lot of my work, early on had to do with the female reproductive system. And that actually was when I had the idea for my book, which mm-hmm. you mentioned, and it was just published, you know, a few weeks ago. It's called A Brief History of the Female Body. And it talks about the evolution of our bodies. I go deep in time because, you know, humans are an incredible species. We're really smart. But our bodies didn't just come out of nothing, right? I mean, our bodies have been built on so many ancestors in the past. Those mammals that I'm talking about that laid eggs, that's part of our history. The primates that get periods, you know, I said, we're not the only ones who get periods, that, you know, monkeys and apes that do, that's part of our history. So anyway, I sort of tackle not just pregnancy and periods, but many aspects of our bodies, especially some of the puzzling aspects. There's a lot of puzzling things about pregnancy that I think we can't understand well unless we understand that evolutionary history. I would argue.
Well, like lots what? Like, tell me some. Yeah, like I want to know some of those.
Yeah, I mean, human pregnancy is sort of fraught with so many potential problems, more than other species, you know. So I think you have kids. Yeah,
I do. I have two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've been through, I assume you've been through pregnancy. And there's just a lot of things to worry about, you know?
Yeah.
People worry about gestational diabetes, about preeclampsia and high blood pressure. And, you know, a lot of those concerns, those, like, I describe them as like instabilities in human pregnancy. And I think there's a good explanation, an evolutionary explanation for why those instabilities exist. And it has to do with, this is actually a recurring theme in my book and on a lot of the work that I've done. You know, traditionally people think about evolution as, you know, it's something that happens because, you know, the prey is trying to escape the predator, right? Like, or there's something mm-hmm. in your environment, like really cold temperatures that make you evolve all these adaptations to deal with the cold. But something people often don't think about are the interactions between members of the same species, you know, whether it's interactions between males and females over reproduction. There's all kinds of forces that you just don't think about that really affected the way our bodies evolved. And so one of those, you know, the interactions between males and females is a big one, but another huge one, and it's kind of counterintuitive, is the interactions between mom and baby, mother and child. And this is happening, I think the most illustrative sort of way to time period to see this interaction is during pregnancy. But it continues beyond. And so, you know, I call it mother-child conflict or maternal-fetal conflict in my book. And it's, you know, a very established theory in the literature. But the idea is, you know, obviously moms and babies, you know, we can just focus on pregnancy because I think it's easiest to think about it then. We obviously, both sides of this relationship want to make it through pregnancy, right? Again, thinking about evolution and, you know, reproductive success, both mom and baby want to succeed. And so they have to cooperate, obviously. But what people don't think about is the fact that moms and babies are not genetically identical. And so what that means is that we don't have identical interests to our kids. So what we see over evolutionary timescales is babies, like the fetus, trying to get more and more and more from the mother. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the baby is 100% related to itself. And it may or may not be, you know, 50% related to its future siblings, maybe even 25% if the future brother or sister has a different dad. So mm-hmm. my point is, you know, it wants to make it now, and it wants to do whatever it can do to maximize its chances of making it through a pregnancy. A mother obviously wants the baby to make it through a pregnancy. Okay. This is important for her reproductive success. But a mother that is successful reproductively has more than one child. And so, you know, the mother has to think about, I mean, she's not consciously thinking about it, but, you know, mothers that their bodies evolved to sort of think more about the bigger picture, like, okay, I want this baby to survive and I'm going to give it what it needs, but I'm not going to give it anything more than what it needs. Because if I do that, you know, which includes nursing, like if I nurse for 5 years, I'm not going to be able to have another kid. I mean, we know that if you're breastfeeding regularly, you're not going to ovulate. And so, you know, it makes sense for a mom to breastfeed her child, you know, such that, you know, that baby has a great chance of making it, but doing it for any longer than that limits her or reduces her chances of having more children. Mm-hmm. She might have one fewer child if she nurses the one child too long. Right. So my point here is that there is this inherent tension between moms and babies that you see over really long timescales. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I describe it as a tug of war. We see it really, really nicely when you look at hormones. So you said you were interested in hormones. And when you look at hormone levels during pregnancy, they're bizarre. Like some of them are like at super high, high levels, like insulin in the mom. You know, a mom's insulin levels, especially in the second part of pregnancy, are way higher than her levels when she's not pregnant, which is weird. You know, why would you
like, why would that be? Yeah.
So this conflict helps explain it. So babies are also making hormones, many different hormones. It's the placenta that's making the hormones. And so the baby's placenta is making these hormones, and the baby is really sneaky. It basically has this way of making hormones and then dumping the hormones into the mother's blood supply. I mean, that's the great thing about a placenta versus just laying an egg. The baby has no way to manipulate the mother once it's out of the mother's body. But if the baby's staying inside the mother and the baby has a way of tapping into her blood supply, the baby mm-hmm. can release hormones. And we know the baby does release lots of hormones into the mother's blood supply. So one of the hormones, actually a whole set of hormones that the baby releases, keeps her blood sugar elevated. So, you know, insulin is that hormone that takes sugar out of our blood and like gets it to our tissues. You know, we need sugar and, you know, other forms of energy in every cell in our body. And so you eat the food, you eat, you know, whatever you're eating, and the food gets digested and then it gets into your blood and it travels around your body. And insulin is the message that our bodies send to say, hey, let's get the sugar out of the blood because we need it. You know, the cell in the brain needs it. This cell over here needs it. The baby is making hormones that do the opposite. The baby is making hormones that keep the mom's blood sugar elevated. The baby's not only doing that, it's making like these enzymes, basically these molecular scissors that are chopping up the maternal insulin. So there is this tension between mom and baby. Why would the baby want elevated blood sugar? Because the more sugar is in the blood, the more time the baby has to take the sugar at the placenta. So, you know, the baby's getting all of its nutrients from the mother, not just from the mother, but from her blood. And so if the mom is removing sugar from her blood for her own tissues, the baby can't access it. So the baby wants the sugar to stay elevated in her blood. And so this, what you see is really high levels on both sides, which is really interesting evidence of this tug of war, where you can imagine the baby evolved to make a little bit more of those hormones. One of them is called placental lactogen. So a little bit more placental lactogen. That's like the protein, the hormone that's made in the highest amounts in not just humans and all primates. So baby makes a little more of that over evolution. You know, this isn't like in an individual, but over evolutionary timescales, mother evolves to make a little bit more insulin. And then you can just, it sort of escalates over time. And so what we see now is the end result of this tug of war, which is high levels of the hormone over here and high levels of the hormone on the other part in the other.
So where do you see that going in, like, on an evolutionary standpoint? Like, everybody is going to end up with gestational diabetes at some point? Like,
no,
that's gonna
gestational
be-
diabetes does not happen to everyone.
Right.
And it's not good for mom or baby. It happens because, you know, when you sort of up the ante like that, if either side is not doing exactly, like, you know, as long as both sides are making high levels, you're not going to get gestational diabetes because both sides are making the appropriate amount of, you know, the hormone.
So baby's taking the blood sugar out, that it's keeping the blood sugar high, and it's also doing its job by taking it out of the blood, out of mom's blood, right?
I get asked a lot about my morning routine, and to be honest, in this season, a lot of it looks different every day besides what's in my morning cup of coffee. This is the adaptogenic mocha I crave daily, and I have noticed such a difference since adding this to my daily morning routine. Harmony by Organifi has a rich chocolate flavor from a rare cacao called Criollo, packed with polyphenols and the Bliss molecule to support the feeling of balance, as well as maca to support energy levels and alertness. This antioxidant has been known to balance hormone levels and improve reproductive health. Chas Cherry Brie and Shatavari to improve vitality, hormone balance, and has even been known to improve libido and decrease PMS symptoms. I've been pregnant or breastfeeding for the last 5.5 years, and after the last 2 years of not having a period because I was breastfeeding my toddler, I was shocked when my cycle returned because I had zero PMS symptoms like cramps, and I believe that I owe that to Harmony. This drink has really helped me feel more like me again. And as a mama, I really appreciate that result alone simply by adding this yummy blend to my morning cup of coffee. Being in the women's health field, it feels very aligned to share my favorite adaptogenic blend made for women by women. You can use my code TRUELOVE to snag a bag of Harmony at 20% off so you can start feeling more like you again too. That's code TRUELOVE, TRUELOVE, to save 20% at checkout for anything at the Organifi website. You can even stack my code TRUELOVE on top of the bundle where you can save an additional 10%. Choosing a bundle, you can pick any of your three favorite items. I love the collagen, the reds, the greens, glow, as well as my favorite, Harmony. With that said, let's get back to the show.
Yes.
Okay.
But as long as the mom is making enough insulin, it sort of is balanced out, if you will. I mean, the end result is the baby probably is taking more than is in the mom's best interest, but it's sort of a compromise. Where we are now is like an evolutionary compromise. So if both sides are doing kind of what they evolved to do, both mom and baby will be fine. The problem is, if one side is making a little less than it should, or one side's making a little bit more than it should, that's when the problems happen. And those instabilities are more likely to occur when, you know, these amounts are like so incredibly high. So it's not like we're supposed to get gestational diabetes. That's just sort of a consequence of this weird, you know, tug of war that's been happening and sort of you know, it didn't evolve for a purpose. It's just a consequence of the way that this tug of war has happened over time, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
The same with blood pressure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same story. You know, the baby wants more blood, basically, to be traveling through the placenta. And so it is doing whatever it can to
stimulate that. Yeah.
Stimulate that. And the mom is doing the opposite. And so it's, you know, when everything is sort of working the way it should be. And when I say should be, like, we're at this compromise, right? Because if everyone got preeclampsia and didn't make it through pregnancy, obviously that's not good for anyone.
Right.
It happens just because of that inherent instability. Because of the way things have evolved. Yeah.
And you also mentioned, since we're kind of on this topic of like the tug of war during pregnancy, I saw you mentioned somewhere that morning sickness can kind of be another example of that kind of this. It's like, and like some women get it and some women don't, but it is kind of like the same instability idea that you've been talking about.
Yeah. So we surprisingly know very little about morning sickness, and there's tons of ideas out there. I think what the post that you're mentioning, there's a really new study that linked the levels of this one protein that's made by the baby. It's made by the baby's placenta. Oh my gosh, I'm not going to remember the name of it, GDH something. It's some sort of growth hormone. The baby makes it in huge amounts. And what they've figured out, the researchers who are studying this, figured out this correlation between the levels of this protein and whether a woman experiences morning sickness or not. And so, mm-hmm. So higher levels of this hormone or this, yeah, growth factor, higher levels of it, results in, you know, more extreme morning sickness. And so I don't know I think we don't know enough about this to say that that is caused by this conflict of interest. You know, this hormone, so it, we also make it in the non-pregnant. The story is really interesting. So we make it when we're not pregnant, and it is involved in throwing up. So, you know, like it's almost like we make this if we're exposed to something toxic, and it makes us want to throw that up.
Right. That's so interesting that then the baby makes it.
Well, so then
during
the baby's
pregnancy, like, why are you throwing up? Yeah, like it's telling you to throw up, but like why?
So one thought is, you know, at the times that morning sickness is really bad, that is the period of pregnancy where babies are most vulnerable to things that could harm its development. And so one thought is that it's, you know, the baby's basically telling mom, don't eat anything, essentially, or don't eat anything that could potentially mess up my development.
Like only eat saltine crackers and toast because you can't undercook toast.
Right.
That makes so much sense. That's like so crazy.
The revulsion to meat. A lot of women cannot touch meat in, you know, if they're mm-hmm. having morning sickness. And, you know, you know, meat can be a problem, right? I mean, if it's not cooked through, if it's, you know, you're not supposed to eat raw meat or raw soup, you know. So one thought is that it's, you know, the baby's, that this is a good thing for mom
it's
and
like
baby.
It's like a protective factor. That's so crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're thinking like, oh, how unlucky for us, you know, but it's like our body is so much more intelligent than we are. And maybe knows more, you know, that maybe you're more susceptible than someone else or this baby is more susceptible for some reason. How interesting.
Yeah.
Because some pregnancies will have, like, you'll be more like, you know, a boy and a girl, one will have morning sickness and the other won't, like if you're pregnant with a boy, but I don't know if there's any truth to that, but like maybe this fetus was more susceptible than another in the same mom. I mean,
possibly,
I don't know.
Or just that it, you know, Because what we know about this gene is that there's different variants of it. So there's, so people who have, I'm not going to be able to say this, but you know, the thing that Kate Middleton had when she was pregnant with her kids, hyper.
Oh yeah. HG. We'll just call it HG.
Yes.
Where you just throw up unstoppable. Yes. You have to go to the hospital to get on medication because you're dehydrated and malnourished and all that.
Yeah. So it's like extreme nausea and vomiting during pregnancy. Yeah. And what these same researchers found is that women who have that have a certain version of that gene. This is, the story is complex, but it's really interesting. It turns out that people who don't make very much of this protein when they're not pregnant, and because of these gene variants, get really sick when they're exposed to what the baby's making. It's almost like, you know,
like low tolerance.
Yes. Like if you build up the tolerance because you're being exposed to it over your life, then you do okay. But if you don't build up that tolerance, it's like a shock to your system and it gets really sick. And they have identified the variant, the gene versions that aren't responsible for that. So it's not just what the baby's doing. It's also the mom's genetics that are contributing to this.
Right.
So complex, but really fascinating.
Yeah. So interesting. Okay. So we've kind of touched on a few of these already.
Do you want to talk about periods?
I do want to talk about periods. Okay, so this is something that's kind of new for me and why I'm kind of really hyper-focused on hormones right now. And you mentioned extended breastfeeding impacting a mother's ability to get pregnant. And I would like to, if you have information on this, I would like to know what you know. I am an extended breastfeeder. So I am breastfeeding my second child, and she is about 2.5 now. I've had 4 periods as of like since she's been born. So I've had 4 consecutive periods. I just started having my cycle again. And I'm not ovulating, which I didn't know that I could have a period without ovulating. And I have never had this issue before. I got pregnant with my first daughter. And I didn't get my period back until she was just under 2, and we stopped breastfeeding at 2. And we had, I had gotten pregnant, we had lost that baby, and then I got pregnant again. And by the time my daughter was 2, we had stopped breastfeeding. So mm-hmm. I was pregnant and breastfeeding at the same time for about 3 months.
Okay.
I had my second daughter, and I didn't have a period until about 4 months ago. So she was like 2 and, I don't know, 2 years and 3 months or something. Mm-hmm. So I realized, I thought I was going to have an easy time getting pregnant. We're basically ready and we've been trying. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what the heck? Like on my ovulation days, like should have gotten pregnant, you know, according to me, I'm having a period, like I'm fertile, you know? So I started taking at-home ovulation tests every day of my ovulation phase, and I never got a spike in my luteinizing hormone. And so, and then I was like, okay, this is so strange. And I started getting acne around my forehead and down my cheeks a little bit. And I thought, I was like, it just came out of nowhere. I never have acne. Now I'm not ovulating. And today I started my period, literally today, a week before my period is supposed to start. So something is happening.
So what the heck is going on?
And I don't know if it's just because I'm breastfeeding still. Like I still nurse her just at night and she just falls asleep. It's not like we're nursing through the day. It's very, very minimal, mostly for comfort. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if milk comes out anymore. It's literally like we're in the weaning process. So I don't know. Like, I don't know. Do you know anything?
So, I mean, so there's a lot to unpack there. First of all,
Hey sister, I want to take a minute to talk about the skincare line that I have been using since 2021 that I am totally in love with. I literally never had a skincare routine or regimen at all. I mean, not even a moisturizer until this brand. I'm talking about Dime Beauty. These products are made from clean ingredients. They're vegan, cruelty-free, contain no harsh chemicals. Dime products are also ranked between a 1 and a 3 on the EWG toxicity scale. Super important. As I'm sure you're already aware of or have heard, fragrances can be harmful to the skin, clog your pores, as well as mess with your hormones, which I'm really passionate about talking about. So of course, Dime Beauty products are fragrance-free. My favorites are the mascara, Hyperglow Vitamin C Serum, and the TBT Serum. It's honestly the best clean mascara I have ever used. Dime Beauty is a budget-friendly, vegan, and cruelty-free option for fantastic skincare. Their packaging is glass, making them eco-friendly, and they offer returns up to 60 days, as well as free shipping on US orders over $49. You can use my code TRUELOVE at checkout to save 20% off of everything, even bundles. That's code TRUELOVE at checkout. Now, let's get back to the show.
It is absolutely possible to get your period. And this, in fact, most girls, when they first get their period, you know, they're not actually ovulating those first. So there's this period, it's called adolescent subfertility, or there's a clinical name for it. But it's this time where she's started menstruating, but she's not ovulating regularly. And it's almost like the reproductive system is just like gearing up to get regular, and it takes some time. And I think it's absolutely normal what you're going through. And it's something similar. It's like your reproductive system is figuring out how to start cycling regularly again. Mm-hmm. And so
it's weird because I've had like a straight up 28 day cycle. Like my period starts on the day that it's supposed to start. Mm-hmm. And then this morning I like don't have PMS symptoms or anything. I just started my period. I'm like, what the heck? Like I checked my calendar and I'm a week early. And I was like, wow, this is so strange. You know, what's funny is that my husband always tells me, like, if I have a question, if I'm like questioning myself, like on mothering or like even my